last time.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and this is The First Time on BBC Six Music and BBC Sounds. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the pivotal first musical moments that made them who they are today. My guest this week follows in the modern tradition of music-obsessed kids who've found that their eclectic passion for music can be channeled into a force that can unite people on the dance floor. Like Norman Cook, Andrew Weatherall or Sophie Lloyd, he's someone who understands that the more inclusive your music taste is, the more joy it can bring. Someone who knows that music sounds best when it's shared. As well as being a DJ, he's a producer, remixer, label boss and musician in his own right. I'm very pleased to say my guest on The First Time this week is Errol Olkin. Here we talk about Errol's first experiences connecting with music. Amazingly, he was kind of DJing before he could read, as well as the impact of his family on his awareness of the power of music and how Blue Monday by New Order changed his life. We talk about his first steps into DJing and, of course, his now legendary London club night Trash, which took the concept of the indie disco and remixed it and remodeled it into one of the most potent scenes of the early noughties. Then there's his remixing. We cover key remixes for Hot Chip and his production work, which has seen him work with Later the Pier, Mystery Jets, and more recently, Duran Duran, and the ethos behind his own record label, Fantasy, home of Colin Moccasin, Daniel Avery, and his own psych outfit with Richard Norris, Beyond the Wizard's Sleeve.
Stonecutters made them from stones, chosen specially for you and I. Take our long traveling many miles, knowing they get here. When they got here, all exhausted on the roof leaks, it got started. And now, when the rain comes, we can be thankful.
To open the show, you just heard some of the incredible Beyond the Wizard's Sleeve remix of Midlake's track Roscoe. But I started by asking Errol, as I did with all my guests, when was the very first time he was aware of music?
I grew up in Archway, and we kind of lived in a couple of rooms in what later became the full family home. My dad worked two jobs a day, and my mum was a machinist, so she used to work from home, and she used to make women's clothing in the corner of the living room. I can't remember exactly what age it would have been, but from a very, very, very young age, I suppose I was kind of, I was doing what I'm doing now, you know, like putting on records for her while she worked. So my mum and dad's record collection, they kind of pulled their collection together of loads of 60s and 70s, 7-inch records. And that was bolstered by a record collection that belonged to somebody else, a friend of theirs who had passed away as well. And we just had like a stack of sevens. And I remember they were kept in this kind of red 7-inch box. And long before I could read, I was able to tell records by
really?
The labels. Those were my toys, I suppose. You know, I didn't grow up with train sets or cuddly toys or anything like that. You know, we just had records. We had a dance set and records, and that was kind of it, really. I would just allegedly, obviously I don't remember this, but I would sit there putting records on, taking them off, putting another one on, you know, and playing music all day while Mum made clothes.
So that's like you're playing music and it's making your mum happy. She's enjoying it.
Taking requests as well.
Yeah,
so.
But that's like music is an absolute cornerstone of your family life and you're doing it. You are getting pleasure from playing music for somebody else. There it is at the age of like 4.
Yeah, I should have asked exactly at what age this would have been at. I wasn't even able to speak or read English until the age of 5 anyway, because until I went to nursery, I spoke Turkish. I didn't speak English. So it would have all been alien to me. But, you know, the record collection then was made up of very distinctive labels. I remember there'd be some records that all had like the same name at the top, and that was obviously the record label. So I recognised that. There'd be some of like the Turkish sevens or the Greek sevens that were coloured vinyl, or there'd be this kind of like incredible kind of patterned vinyl, and they were quite distinctive, you know. So there was things to kind of tell things apart, but I was really captivated by a few of those sevens. And also I think probably subconscious to myself, you know, I would have been able to draw how records would make people feel, because there was one or two particular records that got played more than others. And one of those records was Be My Baby by the Ronettes, which was subsequently my favourite single probably of all time, or in the top 3 or 5 favourite singles. And I'm sure many people would agree, one of the greatest pop singles
without
ever made.
Doubt, without doubt. When you start to get a bit older and you start hanging out with kids at school, were you the obsessive one? Were you the music obsessive one? Because, you know, kids like music. Some kids really engage in it. As you say, it wasn't train sets, it wasn't football. You were that kid, completely absorbed in it.
Yeah, I mean, from starting to go to school, around that time, I had a really strong bond with my uncle, who was music obsessive as well. He was going out to clubs, or he was buying records. He would play me music. He would say, "Do you know this song? Have you heard this?" At the age of 10, he called me into his bedroom where he had this amazing hi-fi JVC amp, which had like red LED nice. Lights, which responded to sound. And he had, I think it was a Marantz like quartz record player, which looked like, it looked like royalty or
it's
something,
the future.
You know, the marble on the front, it's a future. And he was an electrician, so he would make things all the time, electrical things. He, at one point, he made like this light installation on his wall where he got all these, I can't remember what he used exactly. Let's say from memory, it was maybe like polystyrene cups, and he put like lights in each one, and maybe it was like a dozen by a dozen, like squared, and they all responded to signal. Like it was like a light organ, basically, but he built it. He also did things like customized his car dashboard to have more lights on it, to be more like Knight Rider, you know? He really put a lot of energy into kind of making things exciting around himself, you know? And I think that's a major influence on me. But he called me into his room, and he said, "Right, I'm going to put a record on. I want you to look at these lights on the amp." So I sat down and I'm staring at this amp, and he put Blue Monday on. It was the first time I heard it. And the lights flickered in sync with that introduction, like drum pattern, you know, with that kick drum. And I remember just like, as soon as the music came in, I was just like, put it back on again, like do it again. And we just kept putting it back just so I could just experience this thing of like sound and vision, I suppose, you know, or sound and light or technology and what I was hearing and it being kind of illustrated in front of me in this kind of magical thing that I'd never seen before. I'd never seen anything like it before. Experience that moment. This is probably a major part of me loving Blue Monday by New Order as much as I do.
Okay, so when you first choose a record to buy, what's the first record you buy? It's a very different thing when you have your record voucher or your money in your clammy little palm and you can go off to go and choose it yourself, because that's a statement of character, isn't it? It's like, well, this is what I've chosen, this is not what's around me. What was it?
The first record that I went out and bought with my own money, that I went to the record shop, that I was like, I need this record myself, was The Reflex by Duran Duran.
Also a very good record.
Yeah. I remember going to Harem Records in Archway, which was on the same block that I grew up on, and going in and asking for The Reflex. Duran Duran. And the guy behind the counter said, do you want the 7-inch or 12-inch? And I was like, what's the difference? And he said, 12-inch, it's longer, it's more exciting things are inside of it, but it's like a couple of pound more or something like that. So I had the money to buy the 12-inch, so I bought the 12-inch. And I remember bringing it back and just listening to it over and over, like both sides. I remember there's a, on the B-side, there's a live cover of Come Up and See Me, Make Me Smile by Cockney Rebel as well. And I think that might be one of the first times I'd ever heard a live recording on a record as well, you know, like a crowd noise, which was really bizarre to me, because the A-side is this kind of incredibly futuristic production. And on the other side, it's like a live thing. And now it's just like, what's this? You know? I saw this like cheering and whatever, you know. So yeah, there was that amazing juxtaposition of those two recordings as well. That was quite a bit of an eye and ear opener for me.
And then many years later, was there a moment when you're standing in the studio with Duran Duran and there's a little bit of you who is that kid punching the air going, this is them, this is great, this is like, guys, can you just do the reflex just as a bit of a check? Can I hear it? Can you play it? That must have been just lovely. What a lovely thing to experience.
I mean, the first day was obviously quite surreal because there's a sense of being a little bit of an imposter on something, you know, because you have that history of being a fan or being 10 years old and listening to the Reflex. And so you're kind of like wondering what you're doing there, you know, a little bit, which I think is a really healthy thing to feel.
Yeah.
I really think that's okay to feel that. I don't think like, I mean, I didn't feel like a competition winner or anything like that to be there, but I felt like, okay, like I really need to process what's happening in that sense and then adjust to it and then get to work, which only took a couple of hours because they're really, they're very kind of, they're very down to earth people as well. Once that was kind of out of the way, it was really easy to communicate and to work together.
Yeah. But they are very much Duran Duran as individuals. In my limited experience of them, Simon Le Bon is Simon Le Bon. They're not like different.
Oh, 100%, yeah.
They're not different to how those stars are. They're exactly the same. And I mean that as an absolute compliment. You know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, 100%. It's that exactly. I mean, they're very much like their personalities. But after a couple of days, you know, you kind of like, you find yourself adjusted. And it's very, I mean, they're just, in fact, the whole process of making that record of them on and off over 2.5 years and through COVID and everything, it was, they're super driven and incredibly creative and committed and very much still in, I think, awe of each other's capability of what they bring to the band, you know?
Yeah.
The personality of what each member kind of brings to it, especially when we're kind of striking upon those things, you know? There's one point where John Taylor was, we were kind of like developing a bass line on this song called Hammerhead on the chorus. And it's one of my favorite bass lines on the record, but you could hear it coming, you know, you could see it like coming from the distance. Like you could hear him.
That thing that they
that,
do.
That thing, yeah. That, yeah, the character of it. It was kind of there, but I was just like, come on, John, like, can you just like push on that note there and rest on there and then just like, whatever, you know, just like directing a bit. And you could feel it in the room. Like the room goes silent. And all we're doing is listening to what's coming through the speakers as to what John's playing. And it's getting there and it's getting there. We all know what it should sound like. We could all picture it before it's there. Not because we know what he should be doing, but it's almost like a photograph coming into focus. And then when it happens, like the room would just like, everyone would just be cheering, and you could feel like he was locked into it, and it was there, you know, and that's what I was trying to kind of achieve. And yeah, it was an amazing thing to kind of like witness firsthand and be there to encourage and to be part of.
You mentioned live music. What was the first gig you went to that really made an impact on you?
You know what? I remember going after school, walking to the Astoria to buy a ticket to see Nirvana on the Mudhoney tour.
Nice.
It was Mudhoney, Nirvana and Tad. Mm-hmm. I remember seeing it advertised, and I walked all the way from school to the Astoria and went to the front desk to buy a ticket, and it all sold out by that point.
Ooh.
So I didn't really know what to do. I looked at what other gigs were there and what other bands do I recognise. One name that jumped out at me was Cud,
okay,
who were also playing the Astoria. And I knew Cud because someone had done me a tape of an album called Elvis Belt and When in Rome Kill Me, which I liked. So I bought a ticket for Cud instead. I think I might have gone on my own, actually. By that point, I just really wanted to kind of see bands, you know. I wanted to go out and hear music that I'd been listening to on my Walkman, walking to school every day, back and forth, to see what it was like as a live show. So that might be one of the first tickets that I bought. You know, by that point, I'd already been going to clubs.
Okay, yeah. So what was the seminal heavens open club moment then, when you're like, this is my club, this is where I belong, these are the people that I want to be with, this is the music I want to hear? What was that club?
That was exactly what happened. The first night I walked into the Dome, which was the Boston Arms in Tufnell Park, mm-hmm, on a Saturday night, and I'd absorbed so much music from television, radio, tapes that were being made for me by some friends, tapes I was making for other friends. And then to be in a room and to hear some of that music amongst other people of your generation. And also at that point in time, you know, 1990, 91, guitar music, it seemed like the biggest thing at that point, like alternative guitar music, you know, for our generation. I'd started buying The Enemy, The Melody Makers. It felt like you were kind of being exposed and introduced and being curated to from so many different directions, you know. So there's music everywhere. And to kind of feel it brought together in a place with kind of like-minded people of a similar age, and just to hear it loud was just a really major moment, definitely.
You've got the Manics down as the first band you fell in love with. What was it about the Manics? I mean, crikey, early Manics, there's a lot to love, isn't there, let's be honest.
I was into bands, obviously, beforehand, and by that point, I was really into bands like, you know, the Smiths and whatever, you know, bands that I think teenagers can fall in love with easily. But I think the thing about the Manics was it was happening parallel with me in that sense. You know, by the time I was kind of really getting into alternative music, the Smiths had been and gone. But I think with the Manics, it felt like you were kind of growing up with them in a sense, you know. I bought a copy of The Enemy. I think it was the one with them on the cover, the first cover that they had. And I just remember reading it and just being, I hadn't read a band talk like them or seen a band look like that before. So I was really drawn in. I was really curious. And when I heard Motown Junk for the first time, I was captivated because it just sounded like nothing else at that time. Musically, it just felt chaotic in the best way. The energy, it was kind of otherworldly. You know, especially at that point in time as well, where as much as I was a fan of records by Stone Roses and had Mondays, you know, they felt like complete outsiders. I was really drawn to that.
Motown!
Another big first would have to be first time you played the DJ set. Not professionally, you got paid. Here we go.
Okay.
First time you played records, and at the end of the night, someone said, all right, there's 15 quid. Well done.
Okay.
First gig.
Well, you know what? It's interesting because, I mean, if I was to kind of dial back in time a little bit, I remember when I was in primary school and I bought a copy of Friend or Foe by Adam and the Ants on 7-inch.
Nice.
And I told my teacher, I said, I've got this really good new record by Adam and the Ants, and I really want to play it to the rest of my class
really?
And stuff. And they said, why don't you bring it into assembly? And one day at assembly, they actually, I said, so Errol from Green Class or something wants to play a record that he just bought. So they wheeled out this kind of mobile record player with some speakers
right.
on a trolley. And I went to the front, stood in front of the rest of the school or whoever was there and put Friend or Foe on by Adam and the Ants and stood by the record player while it played, and then when it finished it clapped and got my record back and that's it.
You were never going to do anything
else. I wasn't
paid
though.
It was like, and after that I studied and became an electrician. No, it was writ large. Adamant and Friend or Foe, a seminal record for my guest on the first time this week, Errol Alkin. Still to come, we get stuck into Errol's club years and the legendary club night, Trash. That's all coming up after the Six Music News.
Six Music. BBC Radio, Six Music.
It's 1:30, I'm Catherine Cracknell. Boris Johnson has warned Rishi Sunak not to water down the legislation he introduced on Brexit as the Prime Minister pursues a new deal with the EU. Mr Johnson said it would be a great mistake to abandon legislation allowing the UK to scrap parts of the current deal. The EU regards dropping those proposed laws as essential to any new agreement. A senior minister has said it's shocking police released personal health information about Nicola Bulley, who's been missing for more than 3 weeks. Officer said the 45-year-old had struggled with alcohol and the menopause before her disappearance in Lancashire. The Commons leader, Penny Mordaunt, said the comments would grate with a lot of women who'd had to put up with all kinds of sexist behaviour. The Shadow Home Secretary, Labour's Yvette Cooper, agrees.
There is a wider issue about the way in which the police has dealt with particularly violence against women and girls, and of course with standards around misogyny and around approaches towards violence and abuse within police forces themselves.
Devon and Cornwall police say a 74-year-old woman who died in Exeter yesterday was attacked with a knife. A man's been arrested. Officers say they don't believe the suspect and victim knew each other. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has claimed China is considering supporting Russia's war against Ukraine by supplying weapons. He's warned China's top diplomat against giving material support to Moscow. Jonathan Marcus, who's a defence analyst at the University of Exeter, says equipment is already going from China to Russia unofficially.
Chinese private companies and state-owned companies have been sending lots of so-called dual-use items to Russia. So you're thinking of spare parts for various pieces of equipment, navigational aids, jamming equipment, and a whole range of other things that could conceivably have civilian uses, but also could help Russia in its war effort.
The former American president, Jimmy Carter, is being cared for at home after deciding to end hospital treatment. President Carter, a Democrat, was in power between 1977 and 81. Christian Benavides, who's a journalist with CBS News, is in the 98-year-old's hometown of Plains in Georgia.
This is a small town, about 600 people that live here, and he truly is the fixture of the town. And for the rest of the country, he is President Jimmy Carter, but here he is just Jimmy, and everyone in this community knows him and loves him, and it's quite heartbreaking for them to be going through this at this time.
The First World War German language film All Quiet on the Western Front is leading the field at tonight's BAFTA Film Awards with 14 nominations. The dark comedy The Banshees of Inisherin is the favourite to take home the main awards at the ceremony in London. That's Six Music News. The next update is at 2:30.
Six Music.
Welcome back, I'm Matt Everett, and this is The First Time with my guest today, DJ, remixer, artist, producer and label boss, Errol Alkin. And that was, of course, David Bowie and Queen Bitch, a record that was a feature of Errol's hugely influential and very fun Trash Club Nights, which ran for an amazing decade from January 97 to January 2007. But how did he first start DJing and running club nights? Here he is.
I think it was like 92. There was a nightclub that we used to go to in Leicester Square called the Gas Club, and the name of the club was called Automatic. And there was a guy called Jeff who was like the promoter and one of the DJs there. And we were kind of tired because everywhere we were going to, we were hearing a lot of grunge. And we were listening to a lot of British music, I suppose the stuff that was pre-Britpop in that sense, you know, that little pocket of time before that. But I went up to him and I said, look, we'd really like coming to your club, but wish the music was a bit different. He asked me like what I would play or what I wanted to hear, and I just said to him, look, I've got some records, I buy records, if you let me play at the beginning, I'll come and some of my friends will come as well, I'm sure that they'll like pay whatever, it was like £1 before a certain time, whatever, you know, we'll get people in early and it'd be good for everybody, you know. But I'd really like to play some of the records that we're all listening to. It felt like we all really liked Nirvana, but there were just so many other post-Nirvana bands that weren't as good, you know?
Right.
That obviously were kind of muffling out a lot of other interesting music that wasn't getting played. And I just asked, you know, can I come and play some records? And he said, yeah. And I played from like 10 till 11 or something like that, the first hour. I got paid in drinks tickets, like 5 drinks tickets. But I had to leave to get back home by midnight. I had school the next day. So I was still in school. He just said, well, do you want to come back next week? I was like, yeah, sure. So came back next week, did the same again. And then after a few weeks, Maybe it was because what I was playing was resonating with some of the people who were going there. I was asked to do a little bit later on in the night.
Yeah.
So I stayed later and played a bit later on. And we were going to clubs every night of the week. Other clubs were kind of hearing of what I was doing on the Wednesdays and said, hey, do you want to come and play some records here on this night? I said, yeah, sure, you know. And you know, I wasn't getting paid much at all. Maybe £10, £20.
But something was happening. You could feel something happening.
Yeah. When I first started DJing, I had whatever I owned on vinyl, a few CDs, and I would sometimes go and borrow records and CDs from the library because I couldn't afford to buy them. So I'd borrow it from the library and I'd come back, and I apologize for this, but I used to tape them, put them on cassette.
Oh, the shame of it.
But there was a cassette player in the club and I used to DJ off cassette as well. And I used to be one of those kids who recorded loads of things off television. Top of the Pops performances, Snub TV, Rapido, The Word, Chart Show, whatever. I've actually got one of those cassettes right here, weirdly enough. That's actually one from 1991.
Brilliant. Old VHS.
I used to record them. There used to be a video wall at the club, and I wired the output, the audio output of the video recorder into the mixing desk, and some things that I only had on video cassette, I would play off video cassette. And at the same time, it would come up on the video wall. So it was like synchronized. But I just pulled together whatever I had. So if someone says, oh, do you have this song? I'd be like, yeah, I've got that, but I've only got it from the time I recorded it off the chart show, off television. So then I would bring in the cassette and I'd make a note of where like they were on the tape and I'd play it off cassette.
I love that idea of like fast forwarding cassettes or VHSs to find the right spot and going between a CD on a 7-inch or and then a video. That's brilliant. It's kind of, even texturally, it's quite an interesting thing to hear, isn't it? Because they all sound so different. The same thing sounds so different on VHS or so different on cassette in a big club.
Yeah. I mean, it was just the necessity of whatever I had at my disposal. You know, like I was only able to afford a limited amount of music to buy.
Okay. Let's talk about the start of Trash then, shall we? Because it's strange with clubs and club nights. As the years go past, the legend gets honed. The story gets told a certain way, you know.
Yeah.
Every night was amazing. Every single amazing person came to the door. The music was totally on point and everyone loved it. But sometimes that's true. Sometimes those club nights are that important and they really mean something to people. And Trash was definitely one of those places.
Thank you. I mean, Trash started purely because I felt that I was given the chance to put on my own night, and I was kind of a little bit tired of being told what I could and couldn't play on some of the other nights that I was DJing. So when given the opportunity to do something where I didn't have to answer to anybody, I felt really invigorated and kind of inspired by that. It started at a very small place called Plastic People, which was the original Plastic People on Oxford Street, not the one which opened up later on in Old Street on Curtin Road. And it held about 180 people. And on the first night, I remember about 80 people turn up. And I wasn't discouraged by it. I just felt, well, those 80 people have made an effort and they seem to have a good time and I enjoyed it as well. So just kind of stuck with it. Because we were doing something a bit different to the other nights that were on every other night of the week, more people started coming. And then by the summer, it was full. And it'd be 180 people inside and about 50 people outside waiting to get in. And it felt great. It was a Monday night. It wasn't that big. It was a lot of fun. It was filled with amazing, colourful, diverse people. And the original Plastic People closed down. We had to find somewhere new to go. I wanted to carry the club on because I felt that we were serving a particular kind of community within the alternative scene. And a lot of people, you know, we had a lot of people who came every week. So it felt like there was something special happening there. It felt like people depended on it. It felt like people were coming there because they were hearing things that they weren't hearing in other places. And I felt a bit of a duty, in a sense, to make sure that in taking it somewhere, we took it somewhere that was good, that was respectful of what had been built so far. So I found a place called The Annex, which was a bit bigger. As soon as you walked into it, it felt nice. It felt clean. and it felt like worthy in a sense of everything that had kind of been built to that point, and it just clicked. And that held 380 people. And I was like, how the hell are we going to get even 300 people on a Monday night? It just felt impossible. But we moved there, and the first night, I think about 400 people came. And then it got bigger and bigger. And then sometimes, you know, you'd have like 400 people inside and about 200 people outside. And about a year and a half in, that place closed as well. So it was the same mentality, you know, like the duty of building something, having a community who depended on it, and also feeling that we were like something was happening there that wasn't happening in other places as such, you know, where do we go from here? And I went into almost every nightclub in the West End to check it out, to speak to people, and nowhere felt right at all. At that point, I'd actually started going to the End to go to like the Skint Records nights and the Wall of Sound nights, but never in a million years did I think what we were doing and what the End was doing was anything that could come together, because it felt so alien. Alternative culture was not viewed as it is viewed now in that sense. You know, it was like alternative clubbing was kind of just felt like it was like just for students. So, you know, cheap alcohol and people throwing up on each other and things like that. It didn't feel like it was viewed in the same way that dance music was. I didn't agree with that at all, because what I was seeing was I was seeing people making as much effort, maybe more effort on a Monday night than people were on weekends in some of the clubs, you know, that I was going to. I thought the records we were playing were as brilliant as any other club that was out there on a weekend. I remember saying to a friend of mine, you know, I said, I want to make alternative clubbing viewed in the same light as dance clubs. I think it deserves it. And it wasn't meant to sound arrogant at that point. You know, we were getting the face and ID and magazines like that coming and noticing what was happening at Trash and started writing about us. So it felt like we were kind of getting some recognition, and it felt like there was an opportunity to do something special. So I rang the End up. I asked if I could speak to the manager, put me through. And I spoke to a guy called Liam O'Hare and just told him what was happening and asked him if he'd heard of Trash. And he said, I've actually been a few times and I love it. So why don't you come in and let's have a talk? And as soon as I walked into the End, I was like, if this can happen, it would be amazing. But Liam was just so welcoming, understanding. You know, when I was telling him, I knew that the people who would be coming on Mondays would be able to afford the drinks there. And he was just like, look, we'll tailor to your community. You know, we'd love to have you.
That's so cool.
And the rest is history, you know.
What was the first remix that you did? Or the first remix you were happy with, should we say? Which one?
The first remix that I had that I'd done, that I felt that I had made something that I was really, really, really pleased with, was for Hot Chip. And it was a boy from school. I really liked the original version, and I was glad they didn't ask me to do Over and Over, because I think that's such an amazing record in its own right. Sometimes you just don't want to touch those records, you know, because what you come up with might just not be as good. But yeah, the Hot Chip one was one where I didn't really fully understand what I was doing at that time, but I liked it in respect of, you know, like how I was designing the remix. It kind of all worked. It wasn't like I had this kind of vision. I was just throwing stuff at it and just seeing what worked. It's quite naive, I feel. I learned a lot from that process as to, like, you can have ideas that might not fully work at that point, but don't throw them out. Just kind of put them to the side, just keep working, and then it might just click. Because I feel that everything that you kind of commit to and put down is valid to a degree. Whether or not that's what you want to put out there as your final thing is down to how good an editor you are after. You know, and that's what I feel is a really important part of creativity. You know, like, what you release and when. You don't have to put out what you made last week, like, straight away. It can sit there for years. You know, it's like some of my favorite artists, their latest records sometimes is a combination of songs that were written at whatever periods over a number of years. It's not necessarily sit down, let's write an album because we need to put an album out, you know. So, and I still play that mix now and again now. I still think it's a good one.
Fantasy, tell me about the first.
Okay.
The kind of ethos behind that first release, because it's also really nice when someone's obviously thought about, it's the equivalent of writing band names on your school books when you're a kid. It's like you've thought about all this, the logos, I know what the logos, I know what the artwork's going to look like, not the t-shirt's going to look like, and obviously the music, but the whole thing is important. You really feel that with your stuff. It's like,
thank you.
It's all got thought and love behind it. It's a proper world, isn't it? One of the reasons we love music is when people think about the whole, not just the image or the brand, but what it all means, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that goes back to, you know, my formative experiences with vinyl and recognizing the things that kind of like knits it all together. And yeah, with Fantasy, I mean, it started off as a singles club. It started off just as a way to help artists that we liked get proper record deals, you know, starting in 2007, you know, 3 months after Trash closed, I started Fantasy, as well as starting to produce bands as well. So I kind of knew that I wasn't going to be able to keep a nightclub going and make albums with bands and start a record label, because that would just have been absolute lunacy. So Trash bowed out on its 10th birthday, and Fantasy and record production began. The first release was by LA Priest, who at that point was the singer of Late of the Pier, which was a band that I was kind of hanging out with. I was a massive fan of theirs, and I really loved like the kind of strange electronic records that Sam was making. And so just said, look, can we put Engine out? I really love it. And I'll do a remix on the B-side. And he was like, but yeah, sure. So it was that simple, really. It was just like reaching out to a lot of artists that we liked, you know. It was never really about being anything more than helping artists get proper record deals.
But then you've got your stuff that comes out under your name, or like, you are the source completely. That's a different thing again, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it wasn't until we started having the opportunity to release an album by an artist that Fantasy kind of changed. You know, the 13th single on the label was a remix that I'd done of Conan Moccasin's track Forever Dolphin Love, which was the first album that was released on the label. That release where the first time where the Fantasy logo appeared on a record, like, I had this idea for a logo, and I needed to have it drawn out properly. So worked with a designer who drew it out, and all of a sudden it felt like it had taken a whole new life, with there being an album about to come out on there. It felt a lot more serious. It felt, you know, you felt more responsibility. And in a way, it's kind of quite similar to running a club, kind of sense of duty that I was talking about. And I really couldn't have preempted what that album would go on and do after that first Conan Moccasin album. You know, I loved it. I was playing it to anyone who'd listen. And a lot of people were kind of quite taken aback by the vocals because it was so unconventional. And some people say, oh, it sounds like it's like a 9-year-old child. The recording's really woolly. And I was like, yeah, it's amazing. I've never heard music like this before. That album is one that I completely love. You know, it still sounds otherworldly now.
I'm sorry.
funny because it seems the way you feel about music hasn't changed from like the very, very start of this conversation. That kid playing music, just fascinated by the images, fascinated by what they can do, fascinated by how much it matters. Why are you like that, do you think?
I really don't know. I feel real escapism through music, going back from a very early age to even now. You know, I do feel that, like, that's what it always offers me. I'm able to kind of go into a different headspace when I'm doing that.
Right.
I've always sometimes been disappointed that I don't have certain qualities that I see other people that they have, in things like being able to finish a lot of things or being able to just, like, I mean, I can now, but there was a big period of time when I would start so many things and I just couldn't get over a particular hurdle. And I would see people, other friends of mine, who would just be able to just go in and do it, and they'd have a very kind of like their own very direct approach to things, and they'd just be like, oh, you know, you just make anything, you know, put it on, do that, blah blah blah, send it off, it's done. And for me, it'd just be like, but I, you know, what if you don't have, like, you know, these kind of elements to it or a particular...
It's got to feel right. It's got to feel...
Yeah, and that's it. And I sometimes have felt that I do things the wrong way around. I sometimes feel that I decorate the cake before baking the sponge or whatever, you know? So that's how my mind works. I sometimes feel like I'm a pyramid, like standing on its point rather than on the base. That's just how I kind of have come to accept it, really.
And the last question, what's the final song? What should we play?
I'd play something from the Beyond the Wizard's Sleeve album, because making an album was something for a while that I didn't think I would get round to. I feel if you're going to make a record, you do really need to shut yourself off from a lot of other things. You can't be a DJ every weekend playing here, there and everywhere, and then come back into a studio on a Monday to make a record. It's, you know, you need to keep some time aside and really focus on things, which is something that me and Richard did on that album, because we'd started it in 2009 and it was plagued by a lot of the problems of being a DJ, that is DJing every weekend everywhere. And so a lot of music just sat there, and Black Crow was a song that was written and demoed in 2009 and sat there for 6 years on my hard drive, just sat there. And there's a lot of music that's still sitting there on my hard drive that I need to get round to finishing or doing something with at some point. But, you know, it's kind of symbolic, I think, of a lot of things that we've spoke about. And I was very pleased to see it finally get released and to finish an album as well, which I'm really proud of. There was a bit of a running joke for a while with a few people around me as to, like, will a lot of this music ever get finished or whatever? And so it was a real hurdle to get it done and released. But yeah, it came out in 2016, the mere 7 years after being written and demoed.
Then that's the song we shall finish on. It's been really good to speak to you. Thank you so much.
You too, Matt. Thank you.
Beyond the Wizard's Sleeve, a sonic brotherhood of Errol Alkin and Richard Norris, and Black Crow from their debut album, The Soft Bounce. So you can see Errol next month as part of the Six Music Festival in Greater Manchester, along the likes of Arlo Parks, Laurel Carner, and a brand new Christine and the Queen show. Check out the full lineup at bbc.co.uk/Six Music Festival. Also, BBC Sounds is your friend if you want to catch up with previous first times. As we speak up there, you can hear my conversations with Chris Cornell, Mark Ronson, Khalees, Janelle Monáe, and my previous two guests on this run, Cozy Fanny Tutti and Barbara Marr. Join me next week for another first time, this time with musician, composer, record producer and survivor William Orbit. Until then, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.